Welcome to Night Call, a production of iHeartRadio.
It's 10:23 p.m. in the Pine Barrens, and you're listening to Night Call.
Hello and welcome to Night Call, a podcast for your strange days and lonely nights. My name is Emily Yoshida. I am here in Los Angeles, and with me, as always, are
Tess Lynch and
Molly Lambert.
We are super excited this week. We have a very special guest, Tom O'Neill, on to talk about his book Chaos, a new book about the Manson murders and CIA conspiracies and all sorts of fun stuff. That'll be in the second half of the show. But for right now, I just wanted to go around and do some recommendations, just like stuff we've been consuming. I wanted to point everybody real quick to the Criterion channel, which if you're not a subscriber, I would highly recommend it. And I am not being paid to say this. They are doing a little spotlight on Susan Pitt, who I feel like is a very Night Call approved animator. She did a film, an animated film called Asparagus, that used to screen in front of Eraserhead when it was on its midnight movie run. She's just a very cool kind of psychedelic illustrator and animator, doing stuff that's very kind of left to center of when you think of the history of American animation, especially in the time she was working, which was the 70s and 80s. They have a bunch of her short films on Criterion right now, so I would check it out. I saw her stuff for the first time at a weird bar in Tokyo, so I was very turned on.
Are they like? You've convinced me to subscribe to the Criterion channel, but done it yet. So what's what is asparagus like?
It's very hard to describe. It's sort of, there's a lot of asparagus, kind of phallic asparagus. There's a whole sequence where a woman basically fillets an asparagus.
Nice.
It's just sort of kind of dreamy and sort of free association-y, all these sort of shapes sort of melting into each other. It's just I don't know. You kind of have to just watch it to understand it. But it does have that very kind of groovy 70s kind of Zap Comics-esque aesthetic and texture and stuff to it. So I can't give a better explanation of it than that.
Hey, Emily, what do you think of The Irishman?
Oh, yeah. I would definitely recommend watching the short films of Susan Pitt because they are shorter than The Irishman. I saw The Irishman.
You are totally immune to the charms of The Irishman.
What charms?
You were confused.
I wasn't confused.
Well, you were what did everybody else think
about
this?
I am confused by the general reception to it, though I do feel like the more people that see it, not to besmirch my former fellow critics, but I do feel like the more I talk to people who are not critics who have seen it, the more I feel a little more, backed up in my kind of antipathy towards this movie. It's just so long. And it's funny because now it's become such a binary thing of either you're pro Scorsese or you're pro comic book movies. There's no in between. It's
No, the in between is Werner Herzog.
That's true.
Sure. Yeah.
He bridged the gap.
Well, he's now, part of the Star Wars universe.
He's in the Star Wars universe, but he said he's never seen any of the Star Wars movies nor any of Jon Favreau's movies.
And he doesn't
always
intend
has the same quote, though. I don't believe him because he always has the same quote anytime people ask him about pop cultural things that are older. He's like, I grew up in a tiny village in Bavaria and I never saw any culture.
But that's so funny. What a good troll to say. He says he never
heard.
He's
such a troll.
He is just doing I don't know her.
He claims he never heard music until he was 18.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure he gave me that exact same story when I interviewed him. It's just one of his, it's in his file of things that he says. But anyway.
I believe him that he's never seen Star Wars.
Sure. Yeah. But he also, didn't he give some quote recently where he's we have to pay attention to the Kardashians, we must keep our eyes open to all the horrors of our culture.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Well, he's not wrong though.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I feel like that's our philosophy in general. It's not that I'm not even a fan of late period Scorsese, although I wasn't a fan of Wolf of Wall Street. I actually saw Silence somewhat recently because I didn't think I was gonna like it, and I watched it and I was it's great. He's a great filmmaker, like, and he's not my favorite by any stretch of the imagination, but this just feels like Netflix paid him a bunch of money to, like, play all the hits.
Right.
Wow, silent Stan, Emily Yoshida.
Do not put that on my gravestone, please. That is not a defining personality trait of mine, but it was disappointing because it's not like I wanted it to be good.
I want to ask Tess now about a movie that she hasn't actually seen yet, but great. I've been closely monitoring her opinions on already. Uh-huh. Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story.
Oh my God. Oh guys, how did you know I'd have opinions on this movie?
Did you see it?
No, of course I haven't seen it.
Well, I put into the universe that it might be a Blue Valentine.
I'm really upset because I reissued my very important Twitter poll asking if people's relationships had been destroyed
right.
by Blue Valentine. Yeah. Yeah. They always lie. I mean, it's like, I know the truth, and people will email me using anonymous email addresses and tell me, like,
my wife and I went on our first date to the right? movie about a relationship breaking up painfully.
Oh my God.
And guess what happened next? But Marriage Story, I am concerned it's going to have the same effect. I'm very concerned that anyone who sees a Marriage Story with their partner will immediately break up.
Obviously, don't see Marriage Story with your partner.
But isn't it right? worse to see it without, in a way?
But also, like, who sees movies like that except married couples on date
night? Well, soon it's going to be available on Netflix, so you'll just be able to beam it into your home and ruin your marriage from the inside.
Well, I think the movie that we all actually want Marriage Story to be is Greenberg. Which is a
you know
great
I've never
movie.
Gotten into Greenberg though,
oh
but
my
I
God.
Felt like maybe I was coming at it from a
Greenberg
place in my life
good,
where
also,
it was inaccessible.
I was saying like Ben Stiller is a way better stand-in for Noah Baumbach than Adam Driver.
Sure, yeah. Well, now they both seem too young to be a stand-in for Noah Baumbach,
right?
Like Ben Stiller is legitimately his contemporary, so it makes a little more sense. I love Greenberg so much.
Speaking I'm going to give movies, it another whirl.
I wrote about Greenberg on Tumblr back in the day.
Nice.
I was like, I am both characters in this movie.
Isn't that how everybody who loves it feels?
Yeah, I used uh-huh. it as a verb a lot. Sort
to
of,
Greenberg?
I would say like, oh, they got Greenberged.
Oh, nice.
Sort of
what
as,
does that mean?
You'll figure it out when you watch the movie.
But I've watched the movie. What does it mean?
I don't know. Like an older man was annoying to you.
Oh, well, story of
talk down to you.
And that's the Kaminsky
and
method.
That is the Kaminsky
that's,
method.
That's now what I say to everything. It always works. I saw The Squid and the Whale when I was on a road trip.
That's
and we
the
were,
rough one for me.
See, I loved The Squid and the Whale. Yeah. I loved it. But I saw it. On someone's ancient television in, like, I don't even remember where we were. Might have even been in, like, a motel or something. And it was in black and white because the TV was a black and white TV. And I was like, what a fine film, beautifully shot in black and white. And I only realized it was not shot in black and white literally last week.
Wow.
Last
really?
Week. And it's so weird when things like that happen where there's information that's so obvious and you've seen this, like, how did I miss it? How did I miss the, like.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's like I've been living in a bubble.
That's like mishearing a song lyric times 100.
Exactly.
But like of all the like he made Francis Ha in black and white, right?
Hated
like,
Francis Ha, by the way.
That's wild. Why?
Hated Francis.
Oh my God.
I also think I may not really take to Greta Gerwig. Apologies. I try. I don't know what it is.
The cinema of New York intellectuals is overrepresented.
That could be.
We don't need any more Woody Allen movies. We also don't even need the ones we have.
Yeah. Well,
see, I never. I was never into Woody Allen to begin with, so I feel like I get a pass with.
What I guess it's just like if we like I understand where Scorsese's coming from. If we stop paying tribute to these things, they will fade out of the cultural memory, and that is like what should probably happen with a lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah,
But it won't if people keep going like, we have to make more fake Scorsese movies and fake Woody Allen movies because that is what we think is auteur movies are like.
I have a question that's not related to these things, but Molly had looked at Live Science, our favorite website, and found an article asking, should we splice human and water bear DNA for Martian travel?
Mm.
Should
What's
we?
What's the answer?
What would a human water bear hybrid look like? Water bears look like faceless bears, kind of, if you really stretch
like
it.
Bears
they
with
look,
a butthole for a face.
They have a butthole face, for sure.
They kind of look like a flesh-colored centipede.
Sure.
Wiggling through the stars.
A human and a water bear cross look kind of like Squidward? Is that right? Like,
So wait, so life science is just like posing this question.
They're just
to
like,
the,
hey, I think what we do what is normally done in science. We see something interesting. Let's try it in mice first. I don't know that splicing mice with water bears is a good idea either.
Water mice?
Because then you'll have mice that live forever. I mean, it's good for mice.
You know, mice have had it so rough for so long. I think we owe it to mice.
I agree.
To give them immortality.
It's not their fault that they spread the plague. Like,
no,
they
not.
Didn't make the plague.
I had a snake fault. And I had to feed it the baby mice. And I still feel so bad about that. Like, I know that the snake would have eaten the mice in the wild, but
yeah, but when you have to face it yourself, it's a whole other thing.
It's a conundrum, and I have regrets.
But, what are we talking about?
Splicing water bears and mice, Emily. Okay. Let's take a night call about a critter of the week, and it's technically a night email. But there has a new critter that is very cute. Unlike some of the critters that we've covered on this podcast, this one is a winner. I actually really like this critter. There have been some where everyone's like, did you see that? And I'm like, I don't, you know, it's my Adam Driver. Like, I don't care. But this one I do care about. So we have a night email from Colleen. Writing this from under the covers as I try to fall back asleep after being jarred awake from a faulty fire alarm scare at 2:55 a.m. That's another night call to be had. Came across this very exciting, scintillating discovery of this silver-backed chevrotain on camera in Vietnam, aka a mouse deer. They are rabbit-sized animals that, despite having mouse-like features, are not rodents. They're hooved. And most importantly, they have fangs? And then she includes some links. Last seen alive in 1910. I think this is so cool, and I will now be kept awake looking at pics of extinct chevrotain. It's tricky. Has there been any discussion on extinct animals and species you'd wish to encounter, Colleen? Thank you, Colleen. This chevrotain, it's cute.
It's really cute. It's like a more kawaii version of a deer. It's just like so little and.
But fangs. I like that deer with fangs.
But where I can't see the fangs in the photos, which we will link to.
It's a little mouse deer.
It's very fetching.
I like its coloration. But I don't like how it looks like. I'm not a fan of its stance. I'll let it fly because I like its ears.
It kind of is jackalope-ish
It's totes jackalope-ish.
Yeah. But a little cuter.
Do you guys have extinct animals that you wish were not extinct anymore?
Woolly mammoth.
That was what I was going to say.
Woolly mammoths are fun.
They're so fun.
Imagine if you were just like on a road trip. You know, in I don't know, the Great Plains, and you saw a woolly mammoth, just like a wild woolly mammoth hanging. Like, that would be very exciting.
I'll tell you what I would like. Those like really giant versions of things that are now small. Like, you know, there was like a beaver that was as big as an elephant.
Right.
Things like that.
Giant sloth.
Yeah. I would be beavers are not very friendly. I would be scared to see a giant beaver.
Were you scared during the full beaver moon?
No, I was made fun of actually recently at dinner for charging my crystals and my tarot card deck under the beaver moon.
What's it called?
To get more powers
under
to make
the
rain.
Moon.
Was it because you kept saying beaver moon?
I love that Prince movie.
Yeah, beaver moon.
Under the beaver moon.
My husband brought it up in front of my parents and I was like, God, stop. They're going to think I'm so crazy. It's like, but I did it. And I guess I deserve to be called out. My powers are increasing, however, and there's a slight chance of rain when we're recording this, and there may be rain next week, so.
Thank God for the beaver moon.
Thank God for the beaver moon.
Should we take a little ad break?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Night Call. We're going to talk about something we've been talking about, wanting to talk about, for as long as we've been podcasting, The Sopranos. Tess, why don't you tell our listeners about your November tradition?
Okay. 10 years ago, I started a tradition, and I haven't done it every year. I try to, but sometimes, you know, I'm just doing other stuff, as one does. But I try to start watching The Sopranos right before Thanksgiving, sometimes on Thanksgiving, from the beginning in previous years. I start with the pilot and I work my way all the way through, and I can usually get it done by New Year's. Like, I'm really committed. But this year, I took last year off. I only dabbled. I didn't watch the whole thing, but I watched some. This year I decided that I am going to watch it. Well, at first I was like, I might just go with the episodes I remember best and then go through all of the episodes in kind of a random order and see how that feels. But now I think, having watched two of my favorite episodes, the finale, very divisive, obviously, mm-hmm. and Kennedy and Heidi, I think I might watch the finale that I just watched 2 days ago again and then go backwards through the series.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. I'm crazy.
I respect this.
Thank you.
If you learn anything new from that, you should tell us immediately. That feels like something like listening to a record backwards.
The clocks will start like spinning in reverse. Yeah.
It's the Twin Peaks remix.
It is. It's really interesting when you start from a strange place in The Sopranos, because it also kind of reminds you. I first saw The Sopranos when I was home. I think I might have been in college, and I was in Connecticut over winter break with my mom, and she had just gotten really into The Sopranos, and it was like on HBO, and it was the Tracy episode, which is also one of my favorite episodes. And I was like, what is this? And I sat down and we just watched it, kind of like, it may have been in high school, but anyway, we were like watching it in silence, and it was so awkward because the Tracy episode is like, I mean, they're all extremely violent, but it was very violent and like had a lot of boobs. Tracy has braces.
Joe Pantoliano.
Oh, yeah. That's like one of the most horrifying episodes.
It's a horrifying episode, but it also, that's The Sopranos for you.
That might have been one of the first TV episodes that ever made me cry.
Like, oh, yeah. That was the, it was so effective. Like, it was incredible. And I think she's actually a yoga teacher now, the actress
Good
who played
for
Tracy.
Her.
Every so often, I'm like, what's up with Tracy, the actress who played, because she's an amazing actor. Like, she's so phenomenal.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd seen her in anything else since then. But yeah.
Tess, your yearly viewing of The Sopranos made me be like, that's a good idea. I'm going to copy you. And then I started doing it too.
It's a really great holiday thing.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I could watch it all the time. And now that we're like so far away from it in the oversaturated TV world, but like so few things are as good as that. I always just
Nothing
is as good, but it's always weird to me to be like, the first batch of shows that were prestige shows that I loved were all like not famous people and just really character driven and not super high budget. And now it feels like it's turned into movies where people are just like, whoever spends the most is going to win.
Yep.
Which also isn't proving to be true. And that's one of the things I'm really stoked about Elena Smith's show Dickinson doing so well, is that it is a very specific vision by a specific person.
Yeah.
Which is also what The Sopranos has going for
it. You guys are going to murder me for saying this, but like, I did watch, I actually started watching Sopranos a couple months ago and just like watched about, I think I watched the first season, or maybe I didn't get through the entire first season. But like, one thing that I was struck by, because I haven't rewatched it nearly as much as you guys, but man, you don't have to go back too far for this, but Sopranos is a great example of it. TV shows that are actually shot on film. Like, there is like a nice feeling there. Yep. And you can taste the difference.
I mean,
it's true.
It's also like, it makes New Jersey look like the most beautiful place in the world.
And New Jersey is beautiful, and it's weird. I was always trying to convince my folks to move to New Jersey, because I was like, it's so cool because you could just go into New York and then you get to be in beautiful New Jersey. And they just like relentlessly made fun of me because they were like, yeah, you just can't even, you can't say that.
Yeah.
It's like, but it is. It's very beautiful in New Jersey.
It's just across the river, but it's 1,000 miles away.
It's true. But yeah, I'm going to force Emily and Molly to be watching more Sopranos throughout the next couple of months. But I did want to recommend, if you are just wanting to watch a single episode, I'm going to make them recommend which ones they love the most. But I'm going to stand for Kennedy and Heidi as one of my favorite episodes. It's the 83rd, I believe, episode. So it's in the sixth season. But it's great for a number of reasons. A lot happens.
What happened? Jog my memory, because it's been a way long time since I watched the sixth season of The Sopranos.
Okay. Spoiler alert. Go away. If you don't know anything about The Sopranos, go away. It is Comfortably Numb is playing in the car with Tony and Christopher when Kennedy and Heidi are two teens, and they just are in this, it's titled Kennedy and Heidi, but they're just like two teenagers on their learner's permit driving at night, and you see them for a brief second, they're having a conversation, at which point Christopher is driving the car. He swerves to avoid them. The car rolls over. Mm-hmm. And then something else happens that I just can't bring myself to spoil.
Okay. That's such an interesting one for you to be like, watch the climactic point of the series.
Well, I don't know if you should, if you haven't ever seen The Sopranos, obviously you have to start from the pilot and work your way through. But if you've seen The Sopranos and you want to like
dip back in,
there's also because... So Paul, you know, Polly's adopted mother has recently passed away. She's having a dueling funeral with another main character who has also died.
I feel like there are no bad episodes.
There are no bad episodes. But also, I think in Kennedy and Heidi, the cat who stares at a picture and meows a lot, I think that, or maybe that's in the finale, but that was like another one of my favorite elements is like the animals who are reincarnations of people who have passed.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So anyway, we are all going to be watching The Sopranos for months and months, and you are invited to join. And if you have thoughts about The Sopranos, give us a call at 240-46-NIGHT.
I think I know which one I'm going to rewatch.
Which one?
Which I don't think is a good episode.
Well, I picked a weird I did Mr. Ruggiero's Neighborhood, which is the season 3 opener, which is like about the FBI bugging the house as a framing device. So it's like only intermittently about any of the main characters. But it features one of my favorite moments of the whole show, which is Tony singing Dirty Work by Steely Dan alone in his car. It's just like a 10-second cutaway. It's one of the best parts of the show. And I watched things around The Sopranos, like The Matrix, which co-stars Joe Pantoliano.
Right, of course.
And the movie Fallen, which co-stars James Gandolfini and Aida Turturro as cops.
God, I love Janice. Another really good one is the Janice Under the Boardwalk thing. But we'll, yeah, I'll get into that later. Emily, which one were you going to start with?
I don't know the title of the episode off the top of my head, but it's the one where Christopher is going to write a movie.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
I just remember that the closing credits on that are Cake, Frank Sinatra. And for some reason, that like stuck in my head. I thought that was like the most epic like black cut to credits that I had ever seen.
They were very good at that.
They were so good. That was one of their finest little flares.
Also, a fine song by Cake.
Oh, great song!
Yeah,
put it on many a mix CD.
Yeah. Before we wrap up the Sopranos segment, we did get a night text. I don't know that our night texter gave a name, but they say, "Hey, night call. Just wanted to share that people always forget that Polly's car horn is the theme from The Godfather, and that's one of my favorite small things on the show."
Mm-hmm. That's a real car horn. Like that's a thing.
You can get a car horn that does a song.
Yeah, yeah.
I hear there's a La Cucaracha one you hear sometimes.
Well, yeah, that one's very common out here, but I feel like I've heard the Godfather one in New York. Well, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Tom O'Neill, our guest this week.
Joining us now is author Tom O'Neill, author of the book Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s with co-author Dan Pipenbring.
Pipenbring, yeah.
Pipenbring. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for taking us on this journey.
Yeah.
People were suggesting Chaos to us before we even picked it as a book club book because they were like, you just should talk about this book on your show because you talk about all the things in it anyway. And then we all just crunched it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you guys crunched it. You finished it today, perhaps?
We went on a spree. Yeah. Yes.
Wow. So this is our book club pick this month for our Patreon. And Molly had already read it. She's been on a Manson journey and a Laurel Canyon journey also. Mm-hmm. So she had read the book, but then Emily and I had about 2 weeks. So in a way, it worked out really well because we too became very obsessed.
Yeah.
Wow. We had no choice.
I feel horrible. I mean, if I'm responsible, but...
No, it was great. We all, I think, highly recommend.
Yeah.
This is a very night call book, and it's super readable. But it also leaves you feeling so confused
about
everything
you think
you know.
Tell us, I mean, just for readers who aren't familiar with the book yet, if you just, like, give us... We were saying this is probably hard, but the elevator pitch on this massive book about conspiracies and, you know, graph charts and everything else that you put together.
Well, it didn't begin as a conspiracy book. It began as a magazine assignment. that was supposed to commemorate the then 30th anniversary of the crimes in 99. And I was just looking at different ways to make that story interesting because it had been written to death, obviously. And I didn't even want to do it, but I took it. And the kind of elevator pitch is I went down a rabbit hole and never got out for years.
20 years.
20 years, yeah. Exactly.
A 1,000 interviews?
We said 1,000 because we decided if I told the true number, I'd look even more crazy. And it's also, how do you define an interview? Is it like so many people hung up on me or shut doors in my face, but I get one sentence from them before?
Right. Yeah.
But multiple thousands, you know. People that I returned to and interviewed again and again, who agreed to talk, it almost got into 1,000 probably. Oh, wow. But the one hits or some of them... they weren't the pleasantest ones. And there's so much that didn't end up in the book. But what happened was I found out that the prosecutor, Vincent Bugliosi, who became famous at the trial and with his book, Helter Skelter, which to this day is the number one best-selling true crime book of all time. Let's say he cut some corners. That's a polite way. But the true way is he suborned perjury during the case and hid evidence, fabricated evidence, manipulated witnesses, threatened people, etc. And when I found that out in the beginning, like in the first year, that's when things started taking a lot of detours and I started uncovering other stuff connected to other historical events and found out that there was a good possibility that there were darker forces at work than just a crazy quote-unquote hippie guy who was telling his followers what to do for him. That might explain it.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things that sets this book apart is how much your voice and your own skepticism about what you're reporting comes through. And just, you know, by the time you're starting to get into the JFK assassination, you're even in the moment, you're like, oh, God, I'm getting into the JFK assassination now. Yeah. It just has this thing of, like, you know, you can see, you know, the next year of reporting or more.
There's a relatability, too, for us all. We've all done some interviewing. Just the idea of getting addicted to interviewing people.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And obsessed with just sort of
the,
like,
reporting.
Yeah. Getting addicted to the reporting, especially when you're like a freelance journalist doing celebrity interviews, as some of us also may have been, trying to like do something more important. You're like, oh, I gotta like, that's going to be the thing that's going to get me out of this.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So I mean, you also got your hair cut 3 times just to interview a source.
One of the stylists to the stars, Little Joe, who charged a lot of money.
I bet.
But my magazine, which doesn't exist anymore, I think I put them out of business too. Premiere was a monthly film magazine. They were the ones that assigned it. I had an expense account, so I told them before I always would take people for meals and stuff like that, but that seemed a lot. It was $100.
This is also like you're telling tales of like a land far away that none of us have ever
seen. It doesn't exist anymore.
Magazines give you a budget and they're like, take as long as you want.
Yeah, it was, well, they didn't, they did in this case, but it wasn't.
You hit the wall.
It was an anomaly that they let me do that because I got the editor-in-chief as obsessed as I was and as desperate to get out of, I think, entertainment journalism because he really believed in the story.
Yeah.
But the expense account that I got from Premiere, I ended up having to reimburse them for all those $100 haircuts and everything else when the whole thing fell apart.
Oh, my God.
Well, I'm still kind of in the process of reimbursing.
But who do you pay? There's no Premiere anymore.
Actually, we'll talk about that when that might sound. It's complicated.
Yeah. At what point did you become obsessed enough and have enough information that was new that you could get your editor-in-chief to agree that this was worth
just a couple months in.
Really?
I had some big breaks a couple months in, but then, you know, stuff would kind of level off and then something else would happen. It was a magazine story for almost 2 years, I think 18 months. After I missed the first 3-month deadline, Jim, the editor-in-chief who believed in this, and really I wouldn't be sitting here now if he hadn't, he just gave me an open contract. He paid me monthly to keep reporting, so I would report back to him every month or two. And, you know, we blew the 30th anniversary deadline in the beginning, and it wasn't until he got fired from the corporate owners for let's say, probably this story, that the new guy came in and said, we want it in a month or two. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I obtained a book agent. And I said, I can't report this stuff now because I'm giving too much away without the answers.
Yeah.
So give me another couple of years, get me a book deal, and then we'll reimburse Premiere. And he said, I can get you out of your obligation to them, but later we'll have to resolve that.
Yeah.
Later's now.
So this was originally supposed to be, as you said, a 30th anniversary story, and now it's a 50th anniversary story.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it being an anniversary year of the Tate LaBianca murders and the trial and everything, you know, it's been very much in the air. Yeah. Your book is a part of a bunch of stuff that's been
in
the culture.
A whole movie came out about it.
A whole movie.
No, only the last fifth of the movie.
I have to say that reading your book really put that movie in a new light for me of like it being just such a fairy tale, especially with regards to just Sharon and what was going on with her personally at the time.
Yeah,
that
Roman
made a lot of sense to me, you know, that the maybe a pregnant woman wouldn't want to be living at like a party house.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, especially with that kind of, there was violence up at that house.
Yeah, but even I feel like in some of the other books, like I've been reading The Family by Ed Sanders as well, just that, you know, they sort of gloss over that aspect of it more because Polanski was still sort of playing the grieving husband for a long time.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's been other things about Polanski that have come out.
I feel like a lot of it is a sort of armchair psychology that everybody has about Roman Polanski just being this like extraordinarily fucked up person who had a lot of fucked up stuff happen to him, but also obviously did a lot of fucked up stuff, and you know, wanting to understand him as a victim in that moment just because it was so horrific.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's obviously so much more complicated.
Yeah,
than
and
that
moment where it's like, oh, it wasn't the end of the innocence because like a lot
the innocence,
of really
yeah, it was already,
yeah, yeah.
A
yeah.
lot of really fucked up things.
What's
were happening.
Interesting about the Sharon and Roman stuff is the UK publishers, which was Penguin Random House, ironically the same company that sued me when I didn't deliver when it became a book deal. This is all in the book if your listeners read it. About 7 years into that deal, the same thing happened. The publisher pulled the plug on it, canceled the project, and that was devastating. And then they sued me for a return of the advance, which was horrible. Oof. But when we sold it in 2017 to Little Brown, Penguin, actually the same publisher who had sued me, and that had taken 2 years to resolve, were the first ones to make an offer for... It didn't make any sense.
My God.
I thought I was being gaslit.
That was total gaslighting.
And they offered exactly as much as Little Brown did. And I said to my agent, I can't even consider this unless they offer more as a sign of good faith. And he said, that's reasonable. He said, how much more? And I said, don't tell them, but I'd be even happy with $5,000 or $10,000. Just, you know, something symbolic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't even do that.
Wow,
and I told them to go to hell. So then their UK branch bought the UK rights of this, you know, so they published it there. And the only thing their lawyers had a problem with in the book, and it was a serious problem, was everything about Roman mistreating Sharon.
Wow.
And,
really?
Yeah. So...
Well, I think
I hate to admit this.
Yeah.
I had to, you know, I had to give in to the lawyers over there. The libel laws are much stronger, and he successfully sued Vanity Fair.
Well, I think we've seen also that one of the ways that people keep stories like that out of the press is by being like, well, it's unprovable. You know, like how did Weinstein keep anyone from reporting on that, on his, you know, being a rapist for so long? It's because they would go after anyone who intimated anything, being like, you can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that also seems so futile because even as recently as last week, there was another rape allegation against Roman Polanski.
I know.
So
they're like, I got in touch. A woman got in touch with me. A lot of people that are kind of crazy get in touch with me since the book has come out.
Of course.
This woman sounds legit. She's gotten some press. She says she was raped by him in Hollywood when she was, I think, 15. And. You know, she's been sending me stuff. I get a lot of that, but, you know, they were so scared of him over there that I'll tell all of your people if they're in, I don't know if you have listeners in the UK, try to get the United States version.
Yeah.
If they read Polish, even the Poland version, which is, you know, his home country, and we sold that quickly too, the rights, They didn't ask for any changes, just wow. the UK.
That's bizarre. I'm also shocked the UK libel laws are hard because I feel like they publish crazy things.
Yeah. Well, you have the tabloids.
Yeah, so, the tabloids are insane there.
But that was a compromise I had to make. So if your listeners are going to get the book and they're in the UK, I don't know how easy it is to buy an American version on Amazon. I mean, I imagine it's just more shipping fees.
Right.
Get that one.
Maybe you can download the American version.
And give it away for free.
Speaking of lawsuits, how many? So I know like Bugliosi threatened you with what, $100 million lawsuit?
That was one figure he threw out, but he basically said, you'll be working for me the rest of your life. And to Penguin, who was still my publisher then, he said, I will own your company and every profit, any of your books made in perpetuity, my family will, if you publish this man's book. So, he was trying to scare me. But.
I would like to corroborate that Bugliosi is a crank, according to a friend of mine who worked at the Lemley Pasadena for many years.
I love these stories.
And he said Bugliosi would come in and like throw a fit at the staff and be like, don't you know who I am?
Really?
Yeah, like all the time. And be like, read Voltaire.
Oh, my Lord.
He was mentally ill.
All the stuff about, you know, everything that came out when he, what was he running for?
DA, there were two different
cases
he was involved in, and he was running for office. I mean, he was kind of like Trump is now. I mean, he was just fearful of repercussions and thought he was above the law. And the milkman case and the mistress case both really were the reasons he might not have won anyway, because everybody in Los Angeles, especially in law enforcement at the DA's office, knew he was crazy.
Right.
He was only there, people don't understand that, he was only there like 6 years. He left as soon as he finished this case because he wanted to be more famous. But Buck Compton, who was the famous, I forget what they call it, managing DA's guy who assigns the attorneys, mm-hmm. I interviewed him. And he said it was the biggest mistake of my career to assign that case to Vince. He said, I created that monster.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you do find as a new angle about the case is you really address the sort of police corruption and the general incompetency of the LAPD is one of the things.
Well, that's what I was always trying to balance.
Yeah.
Is it incompetence or is it deliberate?
Right.
And I had this one retired DA, Lou Watnick, who told me this, and it was so important at that stage of my reporting. He said, you know, I'm looking at this. I had shown him Manson's federal parole file where he kept getting arrested, released. And I had gotten that through a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests. It took me like 2 years to get it all. I brought it to him, and he was literally dying. I can't remember what the disease was, but he was on a respirator, and he's wheezing, and he's like, chicken shit, this is all chicken shit. Like, what do you mean, Mr. Watnick? He goes, well, you know, this can sometimes be explained by incompetence, but this was intentional. They were releasing him when they should have not only violated his parole, convicted him, then sent him back with the New Year's added on.
Yeah, and when you sort of make that connection of like, well, like the LAPD would probably be stoked if people were doing crimes in the name of white supremacy, because that's also what they're doing.
That's in there, yeah.
You know, so when you get to the part about the setup of the LA Panthers, Black Panthers you know, you really frame it in this great way, because I think the 60s, it's like the cool people are always very overrepresented, and the idea that everybody was like, you know, with it and progressive, it's like, no, a lot of people were super square, and they wanted to crush whatever else was happening.
I guess Tarantino kind of got that in his movie.
Definitely.
Because Leo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt's character were old Hollywood, kind of Ronald Reagan-ish.
I wrote the intro for this Eve Babbitt's book, and she wrote this piece about The Godfather, and in it there's this quote where she's like, everybody in L.A. wants guys who look like Al Pacino, because in L.A., like, guys who look like Brad Pitt are everywhere, and they pump your gas.
And I Eve Babbitt like, said that? Or,
yeah, no, I was fantastic. Like, that's exactly what that movie gets right.
Yeah.
I want her to read my book. I should have gone to her for a blurb. She's great.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, that was probably the section of the book where I started to go galaxy mind, the whole section about the sheriff's office and all this, you know, repeated opportunities that people had to put Manson in jail between the parole.
And the surveillance they had on the ranch.
Right.
I mean, I found a document showing that they knew he was coming back from the Bay Area mm-hmm. the day that Sharon Tate was killed yeah. with this runaway girl.
Yeah.
And all that was correct, except that he was really coming back from Big Sur, which is just a little bit below mm-hmm. the Bay Area. But all that stuff was suppressed yeah. and not shared with the defense.
And one thing that always bugged me about the case was I was like, how could they squat on this land for so long yeah. without anyone getting mad? Because like one thing I know about unoccupied land in Los Angeles is like people get fucking furious.
They get yeah. steamed.
Occupy it and you're not allowed to.
Well, also, I mean, they had visited so many times and he was on parole and they knew that he had like an arsenal.
Yeah.
It's just yeah. absolutely nuts. Yeah.
Underage girls, drugs, a machine gun.
Yeah.
And when the cops or sheriffs would come on to Spahn Ranch, he threatened their lives.
Yeah.
And he said, when he lost the ammunition for, I forget what it's called, the banana clips for a machine gun, fell off a dune buggy, he told the cops he wanted it back. He called them. He's on federal parole. I mean, nothing made sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a famous line of Manson's, is no sense makes sense.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, like putting it in the context of all these other sort of operations that were going on at the time to discredit the counterculture and mm-hmm. student protests and activism and the Black Panthers and all of that, it makes... You know, I would hesitate to say like your thesis, because I think there are still like I think there are many questions that are left open at the end of the book. But in general, the premise that like it would be very possible if one wanted to at this time to create an example out of somebody yeah. like a Manson-like figure
mm-hmm.
To, you know, spook everybody out of the 60s, basically.
Right.
And it doesn't feel far-fetched when you look at stuff that's actually on the record that happened yeah. around that time.
And you do a great job of building it, of being like,
thank
okay,
you.
Here's the yeah. first thing that like kind of didn't seem right. And I went into it more and like found all these bugs under the rock, you know,
yeah.
so that by the time you get to like, here's the JFK assassination.
Well, yeah. I didn't sound as crazy, just half crazy.
You say, like,
yeah.
go with me here.
Right. Yeah.
You
know? Yeah, yeah.
And I think because you're coming at it, like, you're not a true crime person you
yeah.
know, by nature.
And that was the hardest part of the book, yeah. was trying to figure out the structure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I got gifted with a fantastic collaborator, this young guy, Dan, mm-hmm. who now has a best-selling book with Prince out. He wrote with
yeah.
Prince, The Beautiful
yeah.
Ones.
He wrote that great thing about... writing that thing with Prince. About
yeah,
just, like,
that's
encounter.
A prologue yeah. to the book. Yeah. I mean, I got him, Dan, because Prince died.
Mm.
So, you know, everything got halted
yeah.
because the family was dealing, I don't want to say fighting. He says, don't say fighting. They're not, but they were fighting over the estate
yeah.
and the book got stopped. So he had probably, he thought a year or 2 years. I'm like, oh, Dan, it took me 20. It's going to take us 5 to write it. And he was just so kind of self-possessed and not in an arrogant way. He said, we'll figure out how to do it in a year or two.
Yeah.
And he helped me with all. I couldn't have done it without him because
yeah.
I had lost my...
Well, you need someone to come in at a certain point
yeah.
and organize the files for you.
Yeah,
so that you
yeah.
can...
And tell me what... I mean, because I lost perspective on... what was most important, what wasn't. We still do, we're talking about possibly doing a second book. And I was telling you guys earlier, there might be a podcast. So, I mean, there's so much stuff that
yeah.
I do want to get out there into the world that's sitting right now in drawers. But
yeah.
at least I got this much because there was a lot of years that I thought, oh my God, I'm going to get run over by a bus. My family's going to not, I told them, you know, what's important, what's not, but there's too much that they're just going to say, all right, crazy brother died. Put it in a dumpster, get rid of it.
Did you become paranoid while you were working on it?
I never really became, I mean, everybody asked me that.
Does it infect you with the paranoia of the case?
The only thing I was really frightened of, I mean, in the first couple of years, the drug guys that I was investigating, who were the big dealers at the time,
yeah.
they were making some pretty serious threats, but I kept thinking, and you know, one of them I have a scene in the book.
Oh, right.
I took him to Coco's for lunch
right,
or
yes.
someplace. And he's, you know, he's in a wheelchair and I have to lift him.
Yeah.
Charlie Taco. And he's, you know, he used to be a very big, strong man, but he was 80 and dying. And he's threatening me while I'm putting him from my car to the wheelchair.
Yeah.
I will fucking kill you, O'Neill, if you write this. I go, Charlie, I could just drop you in the parking
yeah.
lot and drive away. You can't
and
kill me.
And you reach
me.
That point, too, where you're like, I realized that when someone said they were going to kill me or sue me, that meant
like,
I had gotten
something. Oh, yeah,
exactly.
Matt, you were, yeah. But Vince scared me. I mean, some
yeah.
of the stuff I learned that he had done, and as I learn it, I hope it comes out in the book, I started realizing I wasn't dealing just with somebody who was possibly... First, I thought I was dealing with someone that just wanted to make a lot more money by having a more sensational case. Then I realized it was something much more sinister
mm-hmm.
than that
yeah.
and dark. And then I saw what he did to other people who had caught him in stuff. I mean, he went full-on attack, again, like Trump kind of does.
Well, you make the parallels just, between him and Manson, too, that they were the same age.
It's
crazy.
And I could never decide who was crazier.
Well, that they were both, like, what were they, like 34?
30, well, you know? Like 32, 33, I think, when the trial started.
But
they were born the same year.
It was just such a different version of, like, but just that
violent male ego.
The same, you kind of have to be a sociopath to be either a cult leader or district attorney.
Was there any point at which you just wanted to stop?
Yeah, like every other day.
At one point you describe you had 190, I think, binders in your apartment and a whiteboard with the word Manson in the middle and then lines going out.
I thought it was very brave of you to put that like in the photo section in the book.
My Dan went through some of my personal pictures. He said, I want a progression of photos from you aging through this.
Yeah.
And he said, I want to see, do you have a picture of the whiteboard? And I said, I've got it, like, I think just the first year. So you don't see it with, like, 20 pages of paper tacked up around the whiteboard, you know, beyond the perimeter. And I just said, you know what, I want to be, that's what happened. I created a whiteboard as part of the story. Yeah, we'll put it in. So, I used to, I never once, I think, seriously considered stopping. Mm-hmm. But I would think, what if? And then I just thought, how can I get out of bed? I would have wasted however many years at
that
point.
You were just in too deep.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just that. I also wanted people to be accountable. You know, I wanted to report what I found to set it. I know it sounds real presumptuous, but to set the record straight
because you're also chasing people before they die.
Yeah.
It's like that's kind of the thing about the 50th anniversary is you're like, I got to get these people while they're still alive.
Yeah.
And then at the end, you're like, I have all this evidence. Like, does it mean anything?
Yeah.
All the people that could have been held accountable are dead.
I know. A lot of people have accused me. I mean, there's a lot of people who are not happy with this book.
The Manson blog people?
The Manson blog people, internet people, but also people who are part of Vince's world.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a lot of defenders, but I've had some serious
they've come
weird threats. And I know this person really is a member of the family because I said in one response, and I know I'm not supposed to respond, but I'm like, you have to be Vince's relative because the threats are identical to his. Right. They're just
That's
as
funny,
crazy.
Too, because when you said he was a member of the family, I was like, which one?
Yeah. exactly.
This story, we're friends with Karina Longworth, who did the podcast, You Must Remember This series on Charlie Manson. And in her series and a lot of stuff that we've read, like this is really understood has been understood historically as like a Hollywood story, a Hollywood crime story. And obviously your book goes into how it goes a lot further than that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a California story.
Yeah.
But
it's definitely a California story. But I kind of wonder, like having gone through all this reporting and having talked to all these people and gotten such a kind of cross section of like all these different places that people were at in the culture in this time period. And like since then, can you still even think of it as a Hollywood story or is it, has it transcended that?
No, I mean, it kind of ruined me for having any kind of perspective on it as something that just wasn't so sinister and deep, even if I couldn't prove or if I could only present a circumstantial case. But it made me lose such faith in like stuff that I used. I was never naive. I've always been kind of, raised by lefty parents. And but I always was a little bit careful about authority. But at this point now, I feel like I don't trust cops. I don't trust the judicial system. Mm-hmm. I don't trust the federal.
It's kind of freeing in a way, though.
I guess it is. Yeah.
Once you realize, I mean, we were talking about the DA earlier, like the current DA of LA, like hasn't prosecuted any cops who've murdered anybody like a decade or something insane.
Yeah.
It's just like, if you put your trust in those systems to sort of, and you really do a good job also of talking about the connections between the LAPD and the LA Times. Again, something I would have suspect, once you said it, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and there was more there too. I wish.
Well, the LA Times too. I started looking into like the guy who founded the LA Times. This guy Otis was
Chandler,
like a total Citizen Kane.
He was like a Hearst. I mean, he published whatever served his interests.
And he hated communists and anarchists and just
the power structure in Los Angeles in the late '60s was him at the LA Times. Yorty, who was a very right-wing mayor, Reagan, who was the governor, And Nixon became president in January. I mean, he was elected in the fall, but he was inaugurated in January of 69. And Evel Younger, the DA who was in charge of the case, you know, mm-hmm. Vince was working for him, was an ex-OSS guy, which is what the CIA evolved out of. He was a spy and FBI. And not that that makes him automatically, you know, suspicious, but when you look at everything else I lay out about what was hidden and all that, he had to be part, like the center of that wheel.
Maybe I'm the only person to take an optimistic viewpoint away from this book. But like, given all the effort they did put into trying to crush leftism and crush counterculture in Los Angeles, like to me, the fact that it always comes back in some way, mm-hmm. you know, that you can't crush it, you can't crush like diversity.
That's the reason to be optimistic.
And I'm from LA, so I have a vested interest in defending it against being like, well, I was also like, it was satisfying to me because there's so many like apocalyptic Day of the Locust narratives about LA, including the Manson murders.
Yeah.
To be like, no, this was a government engineered.
Yeah.
This was not like something that was born out of here.
Yeah. And like, then I can blame Washington, D.C.
I think the thing that I like was the most paranoid about after reading this book was just the idea of like, what if everybody who ever runs for any office is just like being planted there, like a retired CIA
person? I read another book after this because I definitely kept going down the hole. I read Weird Scenes in the Canyon.
You got to be careful with that. Well, Dave McGowan.
That one was like fascinating because that one was like, I was like, okay, this is too crazy for me. But also then I would like fact check things and they'd be true, you know? Mm-hmm. But he's the person who thinks like everybody's in the CIA.
Everybody's parent was in intelligence, so they have to be in
But then he like makes the first point he makes is like Jim Morrison's dad started Vietnam and it turns out to be true, like his dad was the Navy officer who
I don't know if I knew that, or if I did I might have forgotten.
That's the first point he said. He's like, oh yes, Jim Morrison's dad was the Navy officer in the Gulf of Tonkin, and there's a picture of Jim Morrison like with him as a kid on a boat, and that's true.
Don't send me down on another rabbit hole.
Well, I was gonna say, so now that this book is out and then you're talking about kind of how to adapt it and what's next in that, do you have any desire to look into a new mystery?
Well, I mean, I left substantial reporting about the RFK assassination by Sirhan. And obviously, if people have read the book, you see there are parallels. And not only that, it was literally a year and like 2 months before the Tate LaBianca murder. Same city, same DAs, same cops. And I found out a lot of really important information. And at one point, it was going to be part of the book. And then we finally decided. So that book, I think, is 500 and some pages. Mm-hmm. Little Brown, the contract, only wanted less than 300 because it's hard to sell a book. I know. I don't think they knew who they were dealing with. But they were great. I mean, when we got to, I think, about 450 or something, or 460, I was so pleased. Then I had to do the end notes, and they said, we'll give you about 10 pages. And I said, no, I need like 100. And they said, are you crazy? We gave you an extra 150. So I ended up getting, I did 120 pages. We got it to 60 of end notes at the back.
Yeah.
And that's the most important part of the book to me, because it shows all my sourcing and, you know, the depth of it. But the RFK Sirhan stuff, that could be a book in and of itself. And there's other stuff that I did find out connected to the same scene in Hollywood in 69 that ended up not having any relevance or connection, but I found out some amazing, singular, like standalone stories.
Yeah, some of the dead ends are the most interesting parts.
I know.
And
so
I just
deciding
love all that driving around LA, you know, and the outskirts. It's very cinematic, and it's like the book is cinematic because it's framed that way. Of like, okay, now I got to drive to the valley.
Right,
I got to drive to Death
Santa
Valley.
Monica rooftop.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's very like a Raymond Chandler novel.
I thought that. That's a nice comparison. The guy who's doing the adaptation for the movie spent about a week with me about a month ago, and I said, oh my God, you're going to have a nervous breakdown too. And he said, I don't care. We're not supposed to say this, but I don't care. No, I wanted it to be a limited series. We sold it to Amazon, and they wanted it to be a feature film. Mm-hmm. And this guy is a big deal, and he's like, but I don't know how to, you know, compress this story 20 years into 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's my life. I mean, that's what told me. I didn't know how to do it in the book, and now you're trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be like a limited series, and I actually think he's, at the end of the week, he had a good angle on it, but now I have to wait and see the first draft, and I'm a little nervous about that.
Well, we talk about Zodiac a lot too, as like
the movie.
Yeah,
or,
yeah,
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people say that. I guess his obsession, was it the, I can't remember now if it was a cop or the journalist.
It's
I
the journalist, but also yeah. It's the same thing where it drives everybody to yeah. madness.
Well, it's contagious.
Yeah. yeah.
Because
yeah.
once you start to realize that this is true, then all of a sudden nothing yeah. else lines up.
Unraveling. And,
Tom, what do you do to decompress? What do you watch in your off time when you were doing this?
I drank a lot. I had really bad, bad partners. Anything that could really be dramatic enough to make me not think about it for a few hours. What do I watch in movies and TV? Yeah. I kind of like detective drama and stuff. I mostly only watch streaming now because I need to see stuff that seems as real. I mean, I finally started watching Succession. I'm actually got I'm going to Death Valley tomorrow. I've never been to the Barker Ranch where they were captured.
Oh, wow.
And the cop, if you get near the end of the book, Paul Dusty was a cadaver dog cop who thinks he has sites around the two ranches. He's been trying to get me to go there for 10 years, and I finally agreed to go tomorrow. So I'm going to go for 2 or 3 days. But I'm supposed to go out tonight, but I'm like, I'm not going to finish Succession. I've got to see the last couple episodes. So
and
anything
they're really
like that,
good. They're heard, really good yeah. episodes.
Be careful in Death Valley.
Yeah. Well, why would you say be careful?
Because it's called Death Valley.
I know.
Yeah, is there a specific reason?
No, but also.
Do you know something, Mom?
I thought we were talking about the elements, but maybe you mean Manson family members? Because they are still.
The haunt, don't fall in the hole. That
I know, yeah.
Lived.
Well, I'm looking for the hole.
We're all still looking for the hole.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining
Thanks
us.
Thanks for having me and your interest. This is fun.
Yeah. And for our Patreon subscribers, we'll be releasing our book club episode on Chaos, so we'll be talking even more about it behind the paywall, but good a reason as any to pick up the book and check it out.
If you want me to come back for a Q&A thing or something when they're all done reading the book, if they read it, if they get
totally.
To the
if
end.
If you have any
yeah.
questions for Tom, you can put them through us.
Yeah. 2446 night or nightcallpodcast@gmail.com and we'll pass them to Tom and hopefully have him back on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, you guys. And thanks for picking the book as a book club thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Of course.
Thank you for listening to Night Call. We'll be back again next week. If you'd like to follow us on social media, we are Night Call Pod on Twitter, Night Call Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. You can leave us a night call at 240-46-NIGHT or a night email at nightcallpodcast@gmail.com. As always, we would love if you would support our Patreon. It's patreon.com/nightcall. We have a lot of different tiers available and lots of different bonuses for our supporters. And thank you so much to everybody who's already supported the pod. We'll see you next week. Night Call is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.